Somebody punched up the wrong Unicron feed. Let me write it down. The second most reason you'll see somebody yank it off the air, they can't stand what the director's telling them because they want to do whatever it is that they want to do at that particular moment. So sometimes you'll see a little anger when it gets yanked out of the air. You'll know that there's some interaction going on that the talent isn't appreciating. There are other issues, tone, feedback, so on and so forth. K2RW, K2J.
I can see how you would have latency and delayed feedback, which could confuse the daylights out of you, if you have a lot of digital processing in there. Isn't there a way they can get rid of that that latency, Eric? Go ahead.
Specifically for the shape of the year, I've never seen one of those pop out, but most of them are using that now instead of, you know, having monitors in front of them to hear themselves.
Now, the company that manufactures wireless ISPs, you probably know, Electrosonic, they developed one specifically for the staging theater, and just so happens the broadcaster likes it, and then everybody starts using it. The thing that you're referring to, Dick, usually is the problem of human error in terms of what's being fed into the guy's ISP. That's one thing. But in terms of delay and stuff like that, now, I'll give you an example. I have a studio here in Plainview, and the control room happens to be in New York City. Let me add a drop. Now, you're used to looking at your computer and you play something that's MPEG-2 or MPEG-4, and you know that that's a compression scheme that allows you to send those nice pictures over a little puny piece of wire. We essentially do the same thing, but we use a codec that doesn't need 6 frames in order to be able to start making output. And if you understand the math of it all, there's this concept of doing some recursive processing, and each time you do that, the actual signal is being delayed. So, you know, you have to make 6 frames before you get an output. That means the minimum delay you're going to have just getting from the image sensor out the cable in the back is going to be 6 frames. So, my path from here to the New York actually has a delay of, we use something called JPEG 2000, which doesn't do as much crunching and it uses a wider bandwidth to get there. You have to delay the audio so that the audio meets up with the video. And there's going to be multiple sources in a intercom switcher. Let me let it drop again. And the human error will punch up the wrong feed, which will be the delayed feed. So what you're really asking is, it's not a failure of equipment, it's what we call operator error.
Interesting stuff. Hey, Roy, we're getting participation tonight. My goodness. You've only gone down three of your items of the probably 20 you have. Each night is different. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, Dick, and you can't predict ahead of time. But most of these stories we'll keep for next week, and I really want Paul to do his space report. I'm sure he has some great things. And I want to thank everyone for participating and just remind people again that if you want to contact me, if you want to give me any topics or questions or have any comments to make, it's mailbag@ac2gs.com. And in case you want to see any of the links and the optical illusions and such, it's on the webpage, roy.ac2gs.com. And additionally, for people who like amateur radio electronic puzzles, I also maintain puzzles for another TechNet, but you might be interested in it as well. You can find it at puzzle.kc2rc.com. So it's not my call sign, it's the other club's call sign. But they're very interesting puzzles, and you just highlight them, and they give you a nice answer and explanation. Again, it's at puzzles.kc2rc.com. And thank you very much, Dick, for the opportunity, and Paul, it's yours now.
Very good, Roy. And a lot of good information, including that graph that you had on your website. I did go over to that, and, you know, with all the little dots.
You know, if you look at it slowly, I count to 12, but if you stare at any one position, I'm just seeing two. Am I normal? If I'm seeing two, back to you, Roy, and then I'll go on. Yes, you're quite normal. As I've mentioned more than a few times, evolution has played all kinds of interesting little shortcut tricks to cut down on the data rate and such. And this is just one of many examples of it. Yeah, one or two is the most that you could do at one visual sighting. So you're perfectly normal. And as a complete aside, I'm just curious, have I been dropping out this hour?
Very, very little, but a little bit of dropout is still there. Did you hear some of those dropouts, Eric?
There's a couple of them, but they're few and far between, and they're much shorter in duration, so... I didn't actually see it happening on the display for the voter, because I wasn't looking. But I bet it was before. But as I said earlier, that, you know, it also happens on the set, on the hospital receiver, so I don't know.
We're making progress, but we haven't gotten all the way there yet. Back to you, Paul.
Yeah, I would say it's 95% better. That's the way I heard it. I mean, it was, as far as I'm concerned, not even noticeable, unless I was looking for it. Especially with those topics. They were pretty riveting topics. One quick update from last week. I brought up the topics of those microphones or transducers or whatever they were. They looked like they were on telescopic antennas throughout my neighborhood. There was maybe four of them that were here and there. And census was that they're probably looking for gunshots. So this was apparently a test. And testing to find out where the sounds were coming from. So they must have done it. I don't think they were there longer than a week. So they're gone. They removed them. So just to get an update on those things. But I did get a picture anyway. Let me drop it.
So they tested it in a certain section of your town. Not enough people were shooting at each other, so they removed them. Fuck you, Paul.
That's good. I'm probably in a safe area. Maybe they did a test or something. Who knows? Maybe when the sirens go off and it would mask the noise. But no, those things are gone. And now they're probably in somebody else's neighborhood. Let's see, I was going to talk about InSight. InSight is the mission that's going to Mars. It should be there a couple of days after Thanksgiving. Originally it was going to be there the next day after Thanksgiving. Now it will be the Monday after Thanksgiving. It's going to land in one place. It's not a rover. It's just going to land in one spot. It's going to explore the temperature of the planet, and it's going to look for a seismic investigation. So it's got a seismologist gadget on the lander. Been in route for quite a few months now. Go up on an Atlas V rocket from Vandenberg Air Force Base. First time they did that from interplanetary flight from California. So the InSight will be landing very shortly, actually. And that stands for Interior Exploration Using Seismic Investigations, Geodesy, and Heat Transport. So InSight has an arm on it. It's got a robotic arm. It's going to pick up a seismograph, place it on the surface, and then it's going to pick up the half. It's like a half semi-circle, so like if you took a basketball and cut it in half. It's going to grab this gadget, it's going to put it over the seismograph, and that's to protect it from the heat and the wind. It's got some kind of cushioning on the bottom where the dome itself would move if there was any kind of wind or heat expansion. It's a very sensitive device that could detect the movement of one hydrogen atom. So if something hits at the other end of the planet, the thing's going to know about it. The one
one that we talked about when it took off also has this hammering device that the robotic arm is going to place onto the surface of the planet. And inside this device is a self-driving little like lump hammer. It's going to hammer its way straight down into the surface. They're hoping for about 3 meters. So, you know, if it goes 15 feet in, they'll be thrilled. It's going to drag behind it this sensitive tape that's going to be going down with it. So they'll be able to tell the different temperatures of the planet all the way down to 15 feet and all the different little locations in between. It also has a X-band transmitter to transmit directly to Earth. Plan on figuring out the wobble, what kind of little wobble that the planet might have over time. Once they get the results of that, that might take months or even years of sending signals to the X-band receiver and transmitting it back to Earth. Any little deviation in the Doppler or different location will tell the scientists whether or not the planet has any kind of a liquid interior whatsoever. Trying to figure out the slight magnetic field it might have in some locations of the planet. It's not like Earth, you don't have north and south, but there's dozens of them all over the planet. So they're going to investigate inside of the planet, hence the interior exploration in the word insight. So that's the story on insight. And if you ever want, you would just put a insight into the computer and you come up with a picture of what this thing looks like. It looks exactly like the Phoenix. They had one called the Phoenix back in 2007 that landed very far north on the planet Mars. That was very successful, and since that was very successful, they duplicated that whole system. It's got these big round solar panels that will open up like a fan, and they're around 12 foot diameter each, two of them. That's how it's going to get its power. No nuclear power on this particular flight. Drop it. The W2BL CW goes by. Another flight that was supposed to go up this week has been postponed. It's the ICON mission. This one is going to study the ionosphere. Talking about it for months. Originally, it was supposed to take off from one of the islands in the Pacific Ocean, off of Kwajalein Island. You have a launch facility located there, right near the equator. That was postponed because they were getting some bad readings on the one of the fins on the Pegasus launch vehicle. ICON is the satellite. Pegasus is going to be the launch vehicle. Pegasus is one that gets mounted to the bottom of this jumbo jet. It's a Lockheed L-1011 jet, and gets up to around 35,000 feet or so, 40,000 feet, and then it drops the Pegasus rocket flight, lights off, and off it goes. They've had about 40 of these launches over the years, and it's going to be another one. Originally, they built the Pegasus with Orbital ATK, and now it's part of Northrop Grumman. That goes. The new launch date is to be announced. They don't know what it is, so it's to be decided. See, as they always put on these websites. Sorry, and another vehicle that should be going up soon is...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Star launch will be launched originally from California, and I'm guessing within probably 3, 4, 5 months they should be able to get this thing in the air. Each month that goes by, they try a little bit different tests on the ground. They've been rolling it around on the runway, and it's been getting up to speed. I think they've got it up to 100 miles an hour already. And this is the one with wingspan that's longer than the football field, or longer than the International Space Station. In fact, the wingtips would be into the end zone, running three Pratt and Whitney engines off of 747. So it's really got three 747 engines on one side, another three on the other side, so a total of six. And it'll be launching these Pegasus type of rockets in the future. Paul Allen was the one behind this project. He just passed away last week or so. But his vision is going to live on with this. He'll be able to fly this plane anywhere in the world, pick up a launch vehicle, and drop it from 35,000 feet, and send it off into orbit. And some of these payloads are quite large. Eventually, he plans on launching in a two-man crewed launch vehicle. It's many years down the road, but it certainly has that capability. Probably lift up 30,000 pounds to a low Earth orbit. That's the story on Strato Launch. I've been following that thing for years. It started to be developed probably about 10 years ago. It started to be built around 2012. It's completed now, but it's running as good a test. The engines work. The thing goes down the runway, like I said before. And the next step is to get it off the ground and see how it flies. Talking about Mars, when InSight launched, it took with it two cube satellite systems, Marco A and Marco B. And it turns out the things are very successful. They do have a camera on board and the capability of transmitting telemetry from InSight all the way back to Earth. InSight really won't need that when they go down and land. They'll have the other orbiting satellites that are presently going around Mars do that job. But this will be, an addition to that capability. They want to see if it works. They'll be able to use it in future flights. And Marco A, Marco B is going to wind up in a solar orbit. It's following InSight. InSight's going to dive into the atmosphere. It's going to heat. It's going to be heated up with the heat shield. And that heat shield will eventually separate. And it's got a big parachute. And it's going to land roughly near the equator of Mars. But Marco A and Marco B will just take pictures and send the telemetry back to Earth. And it will fly. They will fly off into a solar orbit, never to be heard from again. But really a proof of concept type of flight. They know now if they want to go back to Jupiter or Saturn or another planet, they could always send these things along, and they won't necessarily need to have orbiting spacecraft, although they would like to have that on every mission. They won't need it, though. These CubeSats, they're actually large CubeSats. They call them 6U, six units. It's equivalent of six CubeSats put together. Sure, each CubeSat is a 10 centimeter cube, roughly 4 inches on one side. So that's the story on Marco A, Marco B. JPL has given them names, but I don't use the names, whatever they are. But I call them Marco A and Marco B. Another spacecraft that's been around since 1990 is the Hubble Space Telescope. That thing has had a problem with its gyros failing. It has six gyros on board, and they're getting down to the last couple of gyros. The last mission to save Hubble was, 2009, I think it was, on STS-135. And they expected it maybe to work around 7 years, so it's already, beyond that point, beyond the servicing mission. So it's already going beyond that point. but things are starting to fail. Not many things, really, the gyro. They need the spinning 19,200 revolution per minute gyros to be up and running to be able to correctly point Hubble exactly in the direction they need. It's got to be stable, and they're working on straightening it out. Last time I read something, they did have it straightened out. So maybe that's the case. I don't think it's back into operation yet. But if they have it stable, I guess it probably is. Also, Chandra Space Telescope, that's the one that works looking at X-rays, has had gyroscope problems, but they found out it was really a glitch. It really wasn't a gyroscope problem. It was software being sent to the telescope, which made it think that the gyros had shut down for 3 seconds. By doing that, it put itself into a safe mode. It just sits there and waits until mission control can bring Chandra back to life. Apparently that has happened, and now Chandra is back into operation. Any questions so far? I still have a few more things to do, but any questions for the space portion of the TechNet?
Yes, I have one, Paul. In the case of InSight, which is going to be sticking a probe into Mars, it's going to hammer it, if I understand correctly, 15 feet down. I'm thinking about the degree of difficulty of making a seismic detector on the end of that rod, which can see a motion that's approximately the amount of motion of a dimension of a proton. So it's very, very sensitive. And yet it can tolerate being hammered 15 feet in the ground. Wow. That a set of requirements that's out of sight to make it that rugged and yet that sensitive at the same time. How in the world do they do that? And by the way, is there only one probe going in? There's not multiple probes. They're not going to get a stereo seismic view. WS2N, K2RIW.
There's really three main instruments on board InSight. One is the radio transceiver. You want to know exactly where the thing is located. In fact, they want it to land in an east-west direction. You know, the panels, the solar panels, one facing east, the other one facing west. They need that for a lot of reasons. And so that's one instrument. The other instrument is seismograph. That's just going to sit on the surface of the planet, and then it's going to be covered up with this hemispherical dome that's going to go above it. So that's not going to be dug into the ground. The one that's being dug into the ground, 15 feet down, is the heat sensor. It's going to take the temperature side of Mars. That's really what it's doing. So, and then you're right. It's just this gadget itself is complicated enough. You would have looked inside of it. It would have this weight, and then it would have an electric motor, and it would push the weight up against the spring. Actually, push a weight up against the spring. Now tension is on this weight, and this motor will eventually keep moving, and then it will slide off this little cam arrangement that they have, and this weight will come down and put force and start driving itself into the ground, and this will happen over and over again. And so it's a self-driving thing. So it drives itself pretty much straight down, and then as it goes down, it will be dragging behind it it looks like it looks like twin leads. It's going to be driving this ribbon down with it, and that's still connected to the spacecraft. And that ribbon has temperature sensors on it, so you're going to have different readings from wherever it makes it down. If it makes it down to 15 feet, you'll have a reading at 15, 10, and 5. There's different readings. That's going to tell the scientists a lot about the inside of the planet. Back to you there.
Okay, that makes a little more sense. So the super sensitive seismometer just sits on the surface, doesn't get hammered in. A seismometer requires a mass, a spring, an outer shell and some kind of a position sensor between the two. And to have that super sensitive and yet survive the hammering struck me as really strange. Okay, so it only sits on the surface and you have the dome over it to make sure that wind and dust doesn't give them phony readings, that they're really seeing nothing but seismic readings. So I think you're saying that's going to sit directly on the surface, no penetration of the surface at all on the seismic detector. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yes, that's right. And got a camera on board and should be able to take pictures and make sure everything's arranged. The robot arm is going to take its time in doing this. I think it's going to take a couple of weeks just to do this properly. You know, it's not like you have a guy on board where you can just reach out and put this over here, put that over there. It's going to go through a big effort to make sure that everything's in the right spot, make sure there's not a big rock in the way or something. That's the other thing. They chose the equator, first of all. They might as well get as much sun as they can, and that's what's going to happen near the equator, rather than going to the north or south. And the hemispheres, they stayed right in the middle. And they chose a place that was boring. There's no rocks anywhere. You know, they know what's exactly in their footprint when they're going to land. 100-mile footprint. There's nothing there. Where the rovers, you know, the scientists want the rover to be near, you know, rocks and valleys, volcanoes. This thing, middle of nowhere. And it's the safest, you know, place to land this thing. Taking that into consideration as well.
The thermal sensor curve that goes down 15 feet, the hammer mechanism that's going to hammer it in, does that hammer mechanism stay on top, or does the hammer mechanism also go below the surface as it hammers itself down? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, that goes down. That's a self-contained unit. The ribbon is set behind it in a triangular case. So as it pulls the ribbon out, the ribbon will follow it down. You know, it's folded, you know. It's not gonna come off of a reel. It's probably a dozen folds on this thing as it goes down. So it won't hang up, but it's attached to this gadget there. The weight will bring itself down. Picture cylindrical weight inside of a side of this thing that's got the whole body of this thing is going to be going down. Then a motor, electric motor, that turns cam and pushes this weight up against the spring. And then as the motor keeps going, the cam is going to be released and it's going to drop. By dropping, it's going to be hitting this pointy, I'm not going to call it drill bit, but bit. Straight down. Then the motor keeps going, turns weight up again, it rises up, pushes against the spring, and it's going to happen over and over. To get this 15 feet down, they're thinking maybe a month or two. It could take that long depending on the surface, but eventually they think they'll get there. So that's the story. To anybody with any questions about this. Okay, last week I touched on the MS-10 Soyuz rocket that was trying to make it to the International Space Station with two people on board, an American and a Russian. They didn't make it, and it wound up aborting, coming back to land back in Kazakhstan, a couple hundred miles away from launch site. They think they know the cause, and there's a possibility, according to Bridenstine, the NASA administrator, that December launch, which was planned originally, might still be able to go off. Launched another Soyuz rocket without a crew, but it's the same rocket from Plyeisk. Plyeisk is another launch facility in northern Russia. Where Russia always launched their military rockets from. And I think it's like 63 or 64 degrees north, where or a Biker Norwich, which is where they normally launch crews from, is around 50 degrees north. The difference, this is a military satellite in space. They use Soyuz rocket, and it was successful. I believe they know what the problem is, that here's one of two things. That this oxygen valve didn't open up, which acts like a little rocket, a gas rocket, which is supposed to push the boosters away from the core booster when it's going uphill. That one of these valves didn't open, allowing the oxygen to do that. There's also some belief that maybe where it was also tied in near the bottom, that something was bent there. Not allowing the proper separation of the booster when it was supposed to occur. They have something called the Korolev cross. All four boosters are attached to a center core. So all five are all lit off at the same time. And near the top, they have like a ball and socket type of joint on each one of these four boosters. And pushing against this socket joint that's attached to the main core. And the boosters eventually almost completely go out, and they lose thrust. And then they have pyrotechnic devices near the bottom, which separate the bottom parts of the booster on all four boosters at the same time, and eventually starts to pull away from them for the booster. At the exact same time when they're pulling away, these valves are supposed to open near the top of all four boosters, and oxygen shoots out. Some of the oxygen that was originally used for these boosters, they utilize that, and it's out at the top in the direction of the booster, forcing in the direction of the core, forcing the top of the booster away from the core, and again, all four do this at the same time. It's a beautiful sight when you're looking down. It would have a camera on top looking down at the four boosters below. Top, push away from the core at the same time, and then they just rotate on the way down exactly at the same time, and they call it the Korolev cross. He's the guy that invented this back in like the 1950s or something when they were developing the R-7, now called the RD-107A. The center booster is the RD-108A, so it's just slightly different, and it's only different in the amount of thrust that it pushes. That's the main difference. Main boost, each liquid booster, four of them, each one pushes like 187, I'll round it off, I'll call it 190,000 pounds of thrust. And each one is pushing against this ball and socket joint. Core in the middle is only firing around 20,000 pounds less thrust than all of those put together. So the main push of the rocket is these four boosters. When they back off, right before they separate, that allows the center core to become the dominant core, and starts pulling away from the other four boosters. So it looks like they probably have that solved, and if that's the case, they'll be able to have a launch with people back to the space station to join the other three that are still up there in December, maybe January. I think they got this thing figured out, and there's another Soyuz launch or two, because the Progress launch coming up to supply the International Space Station also coming up very soon. So this is WS2N, and that's the story on that. One other topic I was just going to talk about, because we brought it up here a while back, is a successful parachute that test that was launched from Virginia, Wallops Island, Virginia. We have a launch facility there, and sometimes they launch sounding rockets instead of orbital rockets. It'll just go up hundreds of miles and then come back. And they had the Aspire test. The Aspire test was to test future parachutes that's going to be used on the 2020 rover that's going to be going to Mars in 2020. So they tested three times, three different rockets over the last couple of months, and Spira launched the original parachute that went to Mars. They did that as a test, and then they launched two more with upgraded everything on this parachute, including being bigger, and it turned out it was very successful. But it goes up straight up, and then comes back down with this heavy weight on there. The weight is duplicating the 2020 rover. That was 67,000 pounds of when the parachute opened up to 1,267,000 pounds. Slow down what will be the 2020 rover. This is going at supersonic speed. There's always been a problem trying to develop these parachutes at supersonic speed. So that was one thing that they needed to fix, because or get right anyway, because of the 2020 rovers are a lot heavier than the Curiosity rover, you know, so they needed to certify those parachutes. So they sent it up on this Black Brand 9 sounding rocket, and turned out to be very successful.
I'd sort of like to know what the 2020 rover is going to do that's in addition to what can be done by Curiosity. And is it going to be nuclear-powered? Paul, go ahead.
Yes, in fact, if you were to look at it, you would say there's not much of a difference between the two. They look the same. They have that big round thing sticking out of the back, and that's the UHF antenna. It's got an X-band antenna on the body. It's got nuclear power, radiators. They look like duck fins sticking out of the back of the rover. Same thing as Curiosity. Same wattage. The main differences that I see is that they're going to have a core drilling gadget on board. It looks like they're going to drill, like 3/4-inch diameter samples. They'll be able to test them to some degree on board the chemical analysis. A test bed that's mounted inside the rover itself. But then they're going to leave these core samples in different locations on the planet. Curiosity can't make core samples. It could drill into rocks, and it can get the dust, and then the dust goes into the scoop, and the scoop goes into the test bed on the body of Curiosity. But it can't do core samples. It can't make the 8-inch long core samples. This one can, and it's going to leave it behind for some future mission in the future. That's going to go up, land on a planet somewhere we're near, where the 2020 rover lands, and it's going to have a rover on that as well. And that one's going to be able to drive over to the different locations where they've left these samples behind. They'll know exactly where they are, and they'll pick them up and bring them back and put them inside the Mars return vehicle. This thing will launch all by itself, all robotically. Go into orbit and meet up with the mothership and back to Earth. So that's a long-term plan, but it is a plan. So they could complete half of that project with the Mars 2020. They'll be able to do exactly that. Another interesting thing with the Mars 2020 is underneath it, we're going to be bringing a helicopter with that mission. Talked about that on the net quite a bit, and that helicopter is going to be able to fly. It's going to be able to take these 1-minute flights, land, and then recharge for a couple of days, and then be able to do the same over and over again. So we'll see how that works, but that's the main two differences from what I see on these two rovers. Any other questions? This is WS2.
A Mars core sample Earth return mission. Wow. Rather than go through all that huge amount of difficulty of picking up a sample and bringing it back home, I think you'd be better off of whatever measurements you're going to make back home, put that kind of instrumentation on the Mars vehicle itself, analyze it right there. But that's me. How are you, Paul? KQRW.
Yeah, they do have two test facilities on board, both these rovers. They got lasers on board and all kinds of stuff. And, you know, it goes through this whole process and, you know, just powder that they drill out of the rocks, core samples, and from what I'm reading, I'm not a geologist, and I'm more interested in how they're going to get to the planet and how they're going to get back. But apparently the geologists say they can get a tremendous amount more more information if they have these core samples returned. They could do on Earth what, you know, what they can't do on Mars, apparently, with these core samples. I would imagine they're going to cut slivers out of them, and they're going to put them through all kinds of telescopes, microscopes, and look at things. That's probably what's going to be going on. Another milestone that's going to happen is in November. Yeah, service module for the Orion spacecraft that NASA's building to eventually go to Mars or eventually go to the moon. Service module will be delivered to NASA. First time you have a major component like this actually being built outside the United States. We're building the Orion spacecraft itself, but the service module, which is equivalent of twice the size of the Orion spacecraft, is actually being built by a consortium of 18 different countries called the European Space Agency. Countries that all had a piece in this development.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Each country will do something different, but the Netherlands are involved. Okay, Switzerland, Sweden, Spain, Italy, Germany, a whole bunch of them. France, Denmark, Belgium, Austria, all part of the European Space Agency. And what's in this thing is propulsion. You've got solar panels that are going to open up. It's over 60 feet long to provide power. It's all being developed. It's going to be shipped here. It's now completed for the first one. And they are brought to you, Florida. Eventually, it's going to be integrated with the Orion spacecraft and everything else to be launched probably 2021 or so. That thing is really behind schedule as well. Like most of these, not only NASA projects, but all the projects, including SpaceX with Elon Musk. He'll make an announcement. He's going to do something, and it doesn't happen until 3, 4, 5 years later. But eventually it gets done. And that's pretty much it. Anybody have any questions, comments for the last, we've got 4 minutes of the net here. This is WS2N.
Question about Hubble.
Okay, I heard a question about Hubble.
Yeah, Paul, KC1SAM, how you doing? Yeah, I heard Hubble was having trouble with another gyro. Any news on that?
Yes, Sam, I know they have the 6 gyros, and apparently they're down to their last gyro. And for some reason, they think they're going to be able to keep this one gyro running, and that's going to be good enough to keep it accurately pointed. I don't see how they're going to do that, so I'm going to have to go to a couple more websites. I guess they could keep it stable, but, can they really move it from one place to another and set up and make pictures? They have 6. They always said they needed 3 to do it right. They're down to 1. Maybe they're down to 2, and they're just going to write it up right. I think they could do it with 2 if they had to. Back to you, Sam.
T2IS comment.
Yeah, I heard they were doing it with 2, then I heard one of those quit, so I wondered about it. And that's a hopeless repair these days. All right, Paul, I appreciate your comment. I'll fall back to you and let you pick up the other call.
Yeah, Yeah, very good, Sam. Okay, you were thinking like maybe, you know, how are they going to do this with one? The other station, go ahead.
Yeah, this is AC2IS. I don't know if maybe my information is out of date, but I recall reading, I think, earlier today that they had three gyros functioning out of six, that three had failed already, and that this time around one of the three working ones had a problem, and that they were able to restore it to functionality somehow, but that their fallback plan was to go to a single gyro, and they did not have a two gyro solution. They had a one gyro solution that limited the functionality and the view that the craft would have. But there's, you know, currently they're back on, a three gyro solution, and if they lose that number three gyro, they drop back down to one. AC2IS.
Okay, that doesn't sound too good. You know, I mean, it's not going to take much to lose that last one. Yeah, that's the problem. These things are spinning like 20,000 RPMs, and they're in some kind of thick fluid, and they only have these little tiny thin wires going to the motors. I'm not sure if the bearings are wearing out or what's going on with these things. But eventually they fail. You know, they've been going like this for, 1990, they've had gyros replaced many times with the five servicing missions that they've had to go up there. But, yeah, this could be the end of it eventually. There's a long distance plan. They're not going to make it, but they would like to be able to have Dream Chaser go up there. That's the one that's eventually going to have people put in the first six missions. They already have a contract with NASA to bring up cargo to the space station, but after that they plan on actually developing a Dream Chaser with people. Dream Chaser goes up on an Atlas rocket straight up, and then eventually goes down and lands on a runway. But they're not going to make it. Their first flight is probably still 2-3 years away. Running out of time. Anybody have any last words? Dick, over to you. This is WS2N, and I guess over to Roy.
Yeah, we're just about out of time. That was TechNet number 1720. That was Space Report number 320. That was Science Talk number 49. We'll be back next week, solving all these problems, it says here. And my last question to you, Paul, is the gyros on Hubble seem to last for a couple of years. The gyros on the Voyager are in operation after 37 years. I wonder if we could have, by some magic, used the Voyager gyros on Hubble, because the spacecraft are very different and do different things. I'm guessing the answer is no. If there's time left over, I'd like to hear a couple of words on that. But I'm going to turn it over to Roy first. So, Roy, well done. We got lots of participation tonight. AC2GS, K2LIW.
Thank you very much, Dick. Thank you very much, Paul. Once again, for the audience, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com, and the website is roy.ac2gs.com. And we'll all be back here next week, and I already have lots of topics to discuss, and no doubt later on this week we'll get new, fresh ones for you. Over to Paul.
Very good. Very good. We'll be here as well. And Dick, if you look up Dead Band, Dead Band, B-A-N-D, is what I'm saying. That's what they're using. Control it. They tend to just stay in one location. Very, very little movement whatsoever with the Voyagers. So they're not using them that much. And right now, if they have to change attitude for any reason, they actually have the little tiny thrusters, which still have fuel on board. So they don't move that thing around too much. It kind of just stays in one position as it goes. Back to you, Dick, and then we'll say 73. But look up dead band attitude control. I think that would be good. But even Wikipedia might have it.
I'm guessing most of the motion of Hubble is done with the gyros. They don't use thrusters, because a whole lot of use of the thrusters would be making gases that would eventually coat itself onto the mirror. That's my guess. Bye-bye for now, Roy. I mean, Paul and Roy. Thank you, you all. See you guys next week.
W2BZ, still around with KC1SAM. KC1SAM, W2BZ. Oh, there you are. I was hoping you were still sticking around. Haven't talked to you in a while, Rich. How you doing?
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System. Tonight at 8:30, W2VL repeater system. Tonight at 8:30, welcome to the W2VL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System. Tonight at 8:30, W2VL repeater system. Warning, the time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the WQVL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System.